This static thing is sort of cellular paper, and if we don't move it, it isn't disturbing in any way. And what we're going to talk about tonight is under the heading, Every Spirit Seeks a Body. And by a strange coincidence, this particular diagram appeared ready-made. I was going to draw it, actually, and then I came in and found it. It saved me an awful lot of time. When this is still, you can easily see that it is a lot of more or less carelessly drawn circles, and they're easy to assimilate because they are still. You look at it, and you look at it, and you look at it, you focus on different places, and you come to a conclusion, it's the same all over. It represents the totality of geometry in ultimate reality. So before there is any manifestation at all of the temporal order, this diagram is a very good representation of what it is like in what the physicists would call maximum entropy, the inwinding of all powers until they no longer manifest, or what in Indian philosophy is called pralaya. And in this pralaya, everything is in perfect equilibrium, everything is in its place, and nothing is happening. Now, supposing I just move this thing a little bit like this, you immediately find that the eye has a problem of accommodating to the motion. Supposing this motion is accelerated and made a bit wider like this, what is the effect on the mind in trying to accommodate these little circles? Is it slightly confusing? Is it uncomfortable? Good. Lady on the front row has been made sick already. That's only the beginning. Now, Greta is very good at accommodating things like this. She knows exactly the right thing to say. So, let's think about this. Every spirit seeks a body is a very old oral tradition. It is saying something about the nature of ultimate reality, about the nature of Godhead, about the nature of spirit. It is saying that spirit, which is an eternal, unavoidable, inevitable, necessary fact of being, cannot avoid its own self. It is sentient and it is power. When we say S, we mean sentience. When we say P, we mean power. When we say S, we mean the subject. When we see P, we will see the predicate. When you're doing your elementary grammar, you will find that you have to learn a subject and a predicate. The subject is what you're talking about. The predicate is what you're saying about it. Predicate means pira, dicate, dicare, say something rationally. Predicate, to say something rational about a subject. S is the subject. The subject is pure sentience. P is the predicate, which is pure power. When this power operates, it predicates. That is, it rationally formulates itself. Dicare, this word, means, take the C out and put a K, which is an archaic form of the same thing. This, dicare, is from DK, dic, and that means, I'll inhibit it, I was going to say something not funny. A reference to a lady who is in our presence. DK means divide and fasten, divide and lock. So when you say dicare, you are actually in the act of speaking, dividing total reality and separating into categories in the act of formulating, and therefore by the mere fact that you take an absolute continuum, ultimate reality. This absolute continuum is the all in all, and there is nothing other than this continuum. And the best thing to say about it is nothing. But if you say nothing, most people in the time process miss the something that you might have said, and they say something. Hence Dikari. You speak. In the process, you divide the ultimate reality by the words that you speak, because the words have conceptual significance. They cut the mind into conceptual groups. So when we say decay, we are. That means to rot, doesn't it? This is not an accident. Decay, to rot, to corrupt. Now you all know Lord Acton's statement about power. Power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. As the governor of the Bank of England, he knew perfectly well that in the ground there was a lot of metal ore. This ore, taken out of the ground, processed in a certain way, cut into little bits, decay, divided, locked in a mould, is called coinage. By imparting significance to these bits of metal, men were persuaded to abandon an ox for a piece of metal with an ox stamped on it. This is a very important swap. They will beat their plowshares into men if the men do not avoid the attack. The essential thing about coinage is that it is coinering. You all know your Bowery, and to be in a coiner is to be jammed where you would rather not be, frustrated. Coinage places you in a very peculiar position. It gives you a talistic, which allows you to look at a sign saying bull or cow or chicken. If you go to Ireland for your holidays, you'll find all the money stamped with something you can eat, from a horse to a shark. And when you look at it, you can say, taking it out of your pocket, I own a horse. I can't ride on the coin. Well, not comfortably, but I can ride on a horse. And this represents a horse. Therefore, if I keep hold of it, I've got a potential ride. This is a very important thing. Now, all the little circles here represent coins. And they are the product of decay. That is corruption of the continuum of ultimate reality. The ultimate reality, we will call the Godhead, the source of the concept of God. Now, very intelligent people who thought very, very hard for many thousands of years about God have defined God as a necessary hypothesis for keeping order. It's a very good definition. Without the concept of good, God is good is an equation, you would not be able to keep order. In the continuum, there are vibrations. And they're quite simple. There are only two motions possible. Think very carefully. The continuum is infinitely extended. Therefore, it cannot go anywhere. Imagine that. Throughout infinite space, there is power. But this power cannot go anywhere because it's already there. There is nowhere where it is already not. Therefore, it cannot move. Hence Aristotle borrowing some initiatory doctrine that he got in the Eleusinian Mysteries, said, really, we should call him a motionless mover. He is motionless, and yet, somehow mysteriously, there is movement. Now, what kind of movement is there in this motionless, infinite continuum SP, sentience and power, subject and predicate? The only motions possible are these two. It can contract and it can expand locally. It can't do this infinitely, which is already there. What it can do is press onto centers and relax and press and relax and press and relax. It cannot do anything else. And yet, out of these two basic motions, contraction and expansion, all the motions of the time process, no matter how complicated, are derived. Now let the circles here represent the peripheries of expansions, and the center in any given circle is the limit of contraction possibility. If I were to go over this and pattern it with dots, a dot in each circle, I would have represented what in yoga is called akasha, the infinite ether. That is an A-K-A-S-H-A. This means absolute lock leakage, absolute lock distribution. There is the infinite absolute. This infinite absolute contracts locally on points. You can't do this with itself infinitely. You can only do it finitely. And when it does this, it produces primary spheres like this. Each one of these little circles represents a sphere. Actually, in this piece of material, they're not on a flat plane. They're actually little globules with air in them, which is very convenient. The black thing is a portion of my dinner. How it got there, I don't know, because it's not been upstairs. It's not black, it's red. The shadow is black. Now, inside each of these little circles, actually on this, which has a definite thickness, you can feel the blobs. I could do the old magician trick about this and say, can I have a volunteer with the lady on the first row, not too inconveniently, feel a blob for me? Is it a blob?
Yes.
You, sir?
Yes.
Is it a blob?
Yes.
You can feel a blob? Are they really blobs?
Yes.
Well, an old what I say three times is right. I've got three witnesses. That's one more than I need in Jewish law. That's apart from myself. You remember Christ did a dirty trick on that, because he said two witnesses establish something, and I am one and God is the other. Quite useful, that, you know. They are actually little air blobs. Actually, Donald had this made for me by a special process. It wasn't found on the floor at all until it was put there deliberately to be found. And that's part of the mysteries of the universe. That everything that is posited is put there on purpose to be found. And I found it after having arranged for it to be deposited. In fact, the putting there was the founding of it. Now, we're going back. Inside each of these little cells, there is a certain amount of air. Air is the symbol of intellect and of spirit. The Latin spiritus means air, and air came to mean spirit, which is amusing. The Greek equivalent, well, it meant spirit, came to mean air. How that happens, the scholars don't know. What was originally spirit came to mean mere air that you breathe. What was originally air that you breathe came to mean spirit. Why was that? Because some empirical experimenters got hold of some rather dull-witted men and laced their lips together and then bung their noses up and said to them, can you think well without air? They didn't reply, and after some time they no longer had chest heavings. So the experimenters had them removed and a fresh set brought in. This time they only laid part of the lip, and this allowed them to reply, it was difficult. These were given a medal because they survived. You can actually give post-mortem medals as well, which is quite a useful thing. A lot of the living will work very hard and drop dead for a post-mortem medal. When we see these globules, we are seeing a diagram of a peculiar process we will call encapsulation. Sometimes medically they call it encystation. That sounds a bit filthy to me, so I prefer encapsulation. You know, a cyst is a sort of little hole in something. The word kissed is the same word, and that's a respectable northern word for the place where your grandmother used to keep her linen. The grandmother, incidentally, is an archetypal image in Jungian psychology for the original substance of all being. And the universe itself is the supreme grandmother's kiss. Any one of these little zones can be considered to be a little cyst, but we're going to call it a zone of encapsulation, because it is captured by a simple process, contraction of this sentient power locally. Remember, the only reason it does this is because it cannot cease to be what it is. It is infinitely extended, so it cannot go anywhere infinitely. So it can do this trick of contracting finitely. Now, first of all, it does this tentatively, that is, it holds it gently to see whether it's worth doing, and it produces a pattern like this very carefully. And this is the first movement impression. It isn't an expression, because there is no outside of the infinite. It is the first impression. This impression takes place throughout infinite space, and it feels then that it has inside it lots and lots of zones of encapsulation. Now, we can borrow a word and we can call them, if we like, ones or unities or monads is a very common word for it. Those of you that have studied well, and there must be most of you, I would think, Leibniz's monadology, will recognize that the monad is nothing but a zone of encapsulation, and it is from this simple impression, the pressing inwards throughout infinite space, that these monads are produced. Now, every human psyche is such a monad, and has its origin in this original sentient power. And it cannot be destroyed, it cannot be removed. It is there as an infinite eternal fact. And its zone of encapsulation has an infinite impression intent upon it. So that every human psyche has actually got infinite support round it, holding it in eternal being. This means you can never cease to be what you are, absolutely. This is why you never need to fear the death of your physical body, because that isn't important anyway, except locally and temporally. The ultimate fact is that you are a zone of encapsulation. Now, having made all these zones tentatively, just holding them in gently, then God tries a little trick. He tries to press in locally in one zone like this and leave another zone alone, and then he presses in a bit more in the other zone and leaves that alone, and he keeps going like this. When he does this, there is an apparent, only apparent, movement from one point to another. If I squeeze the paper here and then I squeeze it here, if I do this very rapidly, with an invisible hand, like the infinite sentient power is, your mind would start rocking from side to side, and there would arise in the mind an idea that a thing had moved from A to B and B to A. An oscillation would have been brought into being. If I were to squeeze the paper here, and then here, and then here, and then here, and then here, with an invisible hand, which I haven't got with me at the moment, if I did this, there would then appear to be a linear progression of a zone of contraction travelling through space. Now, such linear progressions of zones of compression are what you call physical bodies moving about. Your physical body and the body of your car moving about is nothing but a linearly translating zone of compression. And in fact, the continuum has not changed its place. You know that the waves on the ocean appear to be travelling along, but they are not. The molecules of water in any zone are simply rising and falling in a cyclic movement, first in this zone, then in this zone, then in this. You get the appearance of a wave, but in fact that wave is an illusion. It is simply caused by the timing of the uplift of the water in place one, its downfall, the uplift in place two, downfall, uplift in place three, and so on. It is timing that gives rise to the concept of linear motion and change of position. And this is why in Indian philosophy you have the statement that all things of time and space are illusory. The word for illusion there is maya, M-A-Y-A. Now the base ma means to measure and ya means to affirm. So maya means to affirm a measurement. We could say this is just a static pattern and we will say nothing more about it and then we're not in trouble. But if I say I will now start trying to find out the relation between this point, this point, this point, and this point, I import into the diagram something from myself, from my consciousness, which I called a relation. I will try to find the relation between this and this. Where did I get the idea of relation from? Certainly not from the diagram. It's from my own intent to make a relation. When a girl falls in love with a man, or a man with a girl, or even an old lady with a boy, or a boy with a horse, or whatever, there is an intent to make a relation, and this relation is not in the situation. It is in the consciousness of the person. There are no relations in the whole of ultimate reality other than those imported into the situation by sentience positing them. SP. Sentience posits the relation. Sentience defines and says, I will find a relation. There isn't one there, but it will find one by the simple process of making one. So that when two people look at each other and say, aha, we are in relation, that is nothing but their will to relate. And as long as that will to relate remains, they are in relation. Later on one may think, there is no relation. That means that person has stopped willing this fictitious thing called relation. Sometimes a person has willed relation, A has willed relation with B, B has willed it with A, at a certain crucial point, A, because B means a being and A means absoluteness, decides that this relation is too meagre. So A will stop looking for relation. B may then complain, now there is no relation. You are not relating to me anymore. A may reply, there is no relation. He doesn't say, oh, I've stopped positing the concept of relation with you. He usually says, there is no relation. But if you are strictly truthful, he would say, I have stopped positing relation. For whatever fundamental deep motivations of the will, this relation exists only when it is posited by the sentient power. Now, we saw this static thing is not confusing. If this were extended to infinite space, wherever you looked, you found it still, you wouldn't be puzzled by it. But if we go like this with it, and we start fiddling about with it, we can cause some amount of difficulty in following the scansion of it, and this can cause mental confusion. That is all that actually happens in confusion states in the mind, and is a major cause of anxiety, the inability to detect the still pattern underlying the apparent linear activities of events. So here we have the representation, an infinite number of zones of encapsulation. Each zone is a monad, a one being divided from other beings. It is only divided by the function of the compression, nothing else. When you focus, you divide yourself from the environment. If you know you do this, that is quite all right. If you don't know it, and you believe that this division is a real division in itself, apart from your will to make it so, then you have fallen. This is the fall. The fall in the Bible, the fall in all major religions, means no more than the attribution to one of those zones of encapsulation of a self-existence, so that it becomes dissociated from the rest of the infinite total reality. So let us remember that diagram. It represents the infinite sentient power with an infinity of sentient points posited by the sentience within itself, and each one of these is a monad or individuated being which at certain stages of involution, impressing, become recognizable as human psyches. We'll take that diagram away and we'll try another one. How about that one? Now, if I say to you that is a static picture, and I have another one here exactly the same, also static, and I put that one on top. Now, that is a static pattern. These are called Moira patterns, from the Virgin Moira. It's a better pronunciation than the Anglicized Virgin Mary, actually. It's rather more archaic and phonetically more accurate, because in using an O in it, we have suggested a sphere of encapsulation. Now, you see what happens if I move one static picture over another like this. There is apparent movement. Is that movement real, or is it a construct in your mind? Is it difficult to accomplish it? Do you all really see motion, or do you think you do? I think most of you would admit, assuming you're awake, sometimes people go to sleep, that there is an appearance of motion, and yet I will ask again, madam, would you mind? Is the pattern chair moving? Is it a still picture?
Yes.
Or is it a secret movie?
No, it's a
still picture. It's a very simple thing. Sleight of hand. Now, there is another one, and this is rather simpler to deal with. It's quite simple. You can analyze that one immediately. It is lines radiating from the center, or lines from a periphery driving in towards the center. And observe that. You can please yourself. Whether you swear by Almighty God this is lines drawn from a center outwards or from a periphery inwards. I have another one here. The same. All close your eyes, please. And you're cheating. Close your eyes. Keep your eyes closed a moment, because I don't want to upset you with this. I'm trying. Keep your eyes closed. To make them congruent. Can't quite do it, but you do. Open your eyes now. Can you see apparent shading there?
Mm-hmm.
Can you see a pair of kidneys lined on either side of a spine? More or less. Yes. Now, both of these diagrams are identical. If I just move one of them, as if I were making a local zone tremble, that is, contract to expand alternately, slight oscillation, and I go like this. Look.
Mm-hmm.
You see the spider in the web there? Now, where does that pattern come from?
Intersection.
Has it come from the intersection or from your interpretation? Interpretation of what? Intersection. There is a sheet of perspex here and a sheet here. They are not intersecting, are they? It's superimposition. It isn't intersection.
Later.
It was an interpretation that it was intersection. And it isn't intersection at all. It's superimposition.
Intersection being different in what way?
Well, when you talk about intersect, as you define it, don't you mean that forces or lines actually come into contact with each other?
Yes.
One is going north-south, the other east-west, and that they go through this central point. This you call intersection. If they don't, you call it an EMS. This is superimposition. Now, John said intersection because in his profession he has to know about mathematics and electronics and all kinds of things. Therefore, he recognized a diagram of intersections, and one of the functions of superimposed Moira patterns. But he said intersection, and it isn't. It's superimposition and misinterpretation. Now, what is this movement? You see, I'm not moving this top sheet in any sense in a circular way. I'm putting a finger on it and pushing it straight across like that. As I'm pushing it across, what is happening to the pattern? It's not producing a sensation as if something were being pushed across in the direction in which I'm pushing it. It's exfoliating a pattern, apparently, and it's produced a new form here, this sort of crossy form, and that does not exist. And we can make that one apparently move around. This is another illusion. Now, supposing we go like this, I'll ask you to follow it and keep count now. Every time it goes round, shout 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And what is happening? It's a bit difficult to keep up with, isn't it? Supposing I get another one that we had before, which is a different pattern, and I put that one on as well. Now, that's quite complicated. It's a rather subtle process, but if I were to move assistance from gentleman in the audience, or lady, volunteer lady, we'll have the lady as well. Now, we'll have three vibratory movements. I will perform one, Greta the other, and Fred the other. Will you please move that one, Fred? And you wiggle that one. Just submit nicely, and I'll do the other. First, I'll take this off. There's two. Move at random. Go rather slower so that the unfortunate mind of man, untrained, can see that there are factually patterns appearing and disappearing. And while that is going on, I will put this one on. Can you see a spiral line movement appearing in the middle? Almost a vortex going down. Now imagine this process is very interesting. We're going to define this. Ultimate reality is not made of parts. We call it a continuum because it is partless. You cannot separate it in any way. All discrete particles are an illusion, and the reality is a continuum. Now, a continuum has all its qualities throughout itself in every way, absolutely. So whatever we can affirm in one zone of a continuum, we must affirm in all zones. And for convenience, we have three pieces here of transparent material with static patterns on, and they represent...
By something very silk, can you still retain the original image?
By keeping yourself still?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Mm.
Yes. It's a very good practice, actually.
It's
only because you chase it that you get confused. If you actually sit still and let it do its dance, at a certain critical point, you suddenly see that there's nothing there, that the motion sense vanishes. All you can see is some fool idiotically manipulating static patterns. They suddenly become static. And this is the same thing as spiritual release from time-space problems. you suddenly see the thing is of no moment. Moment means point of orientation. You don't orientate towards it, it stands still, then there is no problem. A continuum has its qualities throughout itself absolutely. Here is a plane representing a plane of the continuum. The other two are planes of the continuum. And whatever I can assert of this one, I must assert of the other two, and of an infinity of these throughout infinite space. So if this one can make itself oscillate, contract, expand, vibrate, so can the other two. And there is nothing overriding. This is the most important concept in the whole of yoga and all major religions. There is nothing overriding the continuum. There is no big boss beyond the continuum. The Godhead is one aspect of it. The God is already a definition within the continuum, a hypothesis assumed in order to function in certain ways. But this hypothesis is a reality in the consciousness of the person positing the hypothesis. This is tremendously important. There is no overriding control above the continuum. The continuum is the only control. And any plane of the continuum can do what any other plane can do. Therefore, one of these, Greta, your assistance please, would you move that plane for me? When Greta is moving that, and there are patterns appearing up there, which are entirely illusory, we have a demonstration of the arbitrary movement of a plane of the continuum, a plane or level of the continuum. It is moving itself. She arbitrarily stopped, you see. The continuum has no overriding control over Greta. If I were to try to hypnotize Greta and say you have a profound duty to keep this thing moving, and I managed to convince her that she had, I would be a finite overriding control over a finite zone of ignorance. But she stopped again without my saying so, which evidences to me this proposition. Within the continuum, any zone of the continuum can do what it will. It can interpret what is said, it doesn't have to believe what is said. It can make it a convenience to pretend to believe or to believe for whatever purpose of its own it has. So, see, I didn't even need to ask her then. She sensitively understood that another plane of the same continuum, namely myself, was about to demonstrate something. Therefore, she moved to participate. I do the same here. And now, as we are going like this, we, without prior rehearsal, no rehearsal, Greta?
No.
Cross your heart?
Cross my heart.
No rehearsal. Cut your throat, hope to die.
In due course.
In due course. Yes. Right. Now, without prior consultation as to the mode of movement, Greta and I are arbitrarily moving our planes of being. And there is therefore appearing an unpredictable, incalculable result, a pattern. And this is a product of two entirely arbitrary wills represented by two separate pieces of thin perspex. Yes? So here we are producing a very pretty pattern spontaneously and immediately. We don't need to rehearse. We don't need to bring ourselves into conformity. Whatever we do in the spirit of immediacy will produce something interesting, and providing there are no egotistic persons that think that we ought to manipulate them in a certain way according to their will, then we are all right and it can be enjoyed. Now, if there are any persons that think that we ought not to do this, then they are egotistically and arbitrary in their will to interfere with our entirely arbitrary function of family pattern making. And this is tremendously important because it is the basis of the freedom of the spirit. It means every human psyche is a self-encapsulated zone of free spirit. It means that every human being is fundamentally, essentially, sensually free. Doesn't matter who he is, what he is. He is fundamentally free. And he is entirely arbitrary in his choice. Whatever he brings up from the center of his being is purely arbitrary. Right, we will now try to remember the title of what we're talking about. Getting what we're talking about. What's the title of our talk?
Spirits and bodies.
Spirits and bodies. Every spirit seeks a body. Now let's see why this is true. More assistance arbitrarily given, please, Brenda. You didn't complain that I called you Brenda.
No, it was rather interesting.
Why was that?
I don't know.
I'll tell you why. Because the heat of this thing has warmed you up.
Does one become warm as one to Brenda?
Yes. That's a hint to the boys. Now, the reason why every spirit seeks a body is this. Because in this world of arbitrary fiddlings about, these monads find that they're constantly being interfered with, you see. Let me see now. Will you try to make a pattern that looks like a spider, please? That's not bad, is it?
No.
Now, supposing that is your will, to make such a pattern, but I'm an interfering busybody, and the one thing I don't like is anybody succeeding in anything.
I'm a good spider.
Yeah, so I go like this.
Oh, but my spider's still there.
I say it's not.
Well,
I deny you.
No, I can see it.
You can see it. You know why? If I bring a newborn baby in and say, is that a spider? It'll go, goo. You see, because the baby is interested in goo, not spiders. You're seeing the spider arbitrarily and on purpose to gain your point.
Yes. But you put that on top to gain your point.
To gain my point.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
And this is the reality of human relationships.
Yes.
Each monad has a determination to make a certain pattern.
Yes.
Yeah, I can even allow you to see your spider if I centre this a bit.
I don't think it would matter where you put it. It would still be there.
I wonder. I'll bring a friend of mine in. Still there?
Yeah.
Is it? Very interesting. Very interesting. This illustrates exactly what we mean by suggestion.
Yeah.
You see, most human beings dislike profoundly earwigs, snakes, spiders, all manner of creepy crawly things, because human beings have 9 orifices which they think are their own. And other creatures are not yet convinced. And these humans are determined that nothing shall get in without permission. Therefore, they are scared of spiders, snakes, bet you. I bet you I can prove it. How much money have you got in the bank?
How much money have I got in the bank?
Yes.
About £17.10.
Sorry. Well, all right, it'll do. Are you quite sure that you can win?
Am I quite sure that I can win?
Yes.
Yes.
And I can't frighten him with a spider.
No, you can't frighten
if you if you fulfill
not
the
even a beautiful torrential.
If you fulfill the conditions of the test,
all right.
I give you with a spider.
Yes, okay.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Yes, yes, yes. Do you mind giving a public demonstration?
I positively don't dislike spiders. I like them.
Yes. But supposing I say to fulfill the conditions of the bet,
yeah,
you must first denude yourself.
Yeah.
Is that all right? Is that all right?
I'm a first. Well, that's not quite fair. That's a female statement.
That's a male statement.
That doesn't prove anything.
Women don't believe in rationality and fairness anyway. They meant it was a dirty feminine trick. Because the next thing I would have...
Well, I don't see the connection between being nude and being afraid of spiders.
That's the next step. I would then conjure from your archaic archetypal reactions to spiders long ago, and especially tarantulas.
Yes,
you
see?
They're nice and long and hairy. Did you write that, or did I remember it from another world? I won't steal your money, actually. I know very well I can do it. With a spider. Even in private.
You know, I really doubt that.
Oh, okay. We'll settle this bet on another occasion. I want it in cash, not a bouncing check.
You want what?
Cash, not a bouncing check.
All right, cash.
I'm not sure whether I'm not making myself into a prostitute. Right, now, can you see any spiders on that diagram?
No.
Sure? If I put another diagram identical on top of it, can you guess what it will do? Will it make circles? Any guesses? Well, I put that on there. Yes? Will it make circles? Any guesses? Well, I put that on there. Yes? Now, supposing I rotate it a little bit like this.
It's dark, isn't it?
You couldn't really guess that, could you? Not unless you'd fiddled about a bit secretly beforehand. It'd be difficult. And yet, somebody wondered whether a spider might appear. That was a psychological trick, wasn't it? Really?
Yes.
To get a straight line pattern that doesn't look like spiders, and then look as if a spider might appear. And then somebody thinks, maybe he's got a spider there, and we're not quite sure about this pattern. There is that tendency in the mind. Many horrible experiences. So fundamentally, we trust nothing. Which is a very good thing.
Yes.
The reason for that is that there are comedians in the world who go about saying strange things. So when we have two planes, or two levels, or two monads of the infinite sentient power, and they are arbitrary, we have no guarantee whatever of the resultant pattern of their interplay because of the arbitrariness of their own motions. This is of tremendous significance, because if you wish to be free, and everybody does wish to be free, even though they're rather lazy about the pursuit of the freedom, because they doubt its ultimate possibility, yet freedom is an essential of sentient power, and therefore every being really wishes to be free, and because of that it is necessary to remember that pure arbitrariness is inside every sentient being, so that whatever is being said to you is put to you fundamentally arbitrarily for your fundamentally arbitrary consideration or rejection. What I'm saying is arbitrary, what I'm saying is for your consideration. It may be for you to refuse it, it may be for you to consider it. Whichever you do, you are fundamentally doing it arbitrarily because you are moving towards the freedom you once had and threw away. And the reason you threw it away was because you had a pattern. Now, we've used this expression before. You have inside you a preferred response pattern from before time, from your eternal monadic self, a preferred response pattern. And whenever you go into action, you try to precipitate a pattern of events. You're about to say something.
Yes, you said that before you came this time, you had a preferred pattern. How did you get a preferred pattern?
Backstage one. Preferred pattern is there.
And how is it preferred?
Preferred means rationally born. Now, ratio is nothing but Torah. That means encapsulation, rotation, circumscription. Those little things there allow you, with your sentience, to group them by looking at them. Without moving them, you can look at them and you can decide to see them in threes or in straight lines going this way or straight lines going that way. And you can build deliberately by counting. Look at one and you'll count six round it.
Yeah?
So there is a pattern there.
Yes, oh yes.
And you select a pattern with consciousness before time begins. Time is when it starts to move like this.
How is it, what makes you do that?
Nothing. This is entirely arbitrary. John the Baptist says of Christ, "This is he who coming after me in the time process was preferred before me in eternity." That means if you look at this in a certain way, you will see Jesus Christ. And if you look at it in another way, you will see John the Baptist, or Adolf Hitler, or Mao Zedong, or Zamenhof, or anybody else you care to name. They're all there in a pattern. Because if we were to superstress some of these, make them a little more intense, we could draw in particle form, that is dot pattern, like stippling, any form of any being that could ever come into the time process. And it is the sentience that sees this and has inside itself an arbitrary will, which is peculiarly its own. What it sees there, it seizes like this. And in that moment, it has committed itself. Now, every self-will, every encapsulated sentient power has a peculiar characteristic, and that is that when it wills something, it doesn't like to let go of its own will. You may have noticed this if you're arguing with somebody,
yeah,
and they lose the argument, they turn it round so that what you are saying they meant.
Yeah.
This is a very important thing, because they cannot afford to lose their own preferred response pattern. This is of tremendous importance. So, preferred in eternity. Each monad in eternity, remember they're all there and they're all going like this, tentatively, wondering whether to condense, and they're feeling what pattern is worthy my condensation. And the one that they decide on is their number one preferred response, and it's their fundamental characteristic, and because they have started from there,
yes,
they'll be stuck with this original choice throughout all time.
Yes, all time.
Yes? They shall not go out until they have paid the uttermost far thing.
Yes.
You've got to go right on to the end of the line because of this profound monadic intent to be proved right in your original preferred response declaration.
Yep.
Yeah?
Yep.
And that's why human beings find it extraordinarily difficult to give up even manifestly, demonstratedly inefficient activities.
And so already the shocking attitude that's given themselves. Can't they stand back from the lot and say, "I'm not killing myself"?
Within the infinite possibility, there must be some of those. But we know that in the time process on Earth, they are very, very rare. And we know in dealing with human beings, there are very, very few people who even contemplate the idea of not being right in the chosen way. The ability to not be right is very, very important. This week's deliberate mistake. Yeah? Any Muslim carpet maker makes a deliberate mistake in his carpet. He does this on purpose because of two reasons. The exoteric told to the populace is this: we put a deliberate mistake in the carpet because God might get mad at us if we did it right. He is the only perfect, and the Lord thy God is a jealous God. You make a flawless carpet, he'll get mad and stamp his black feet on it, because you know God has a black aspect as well as a white aspect, and he put his black feet on your new white perfectly designed carpet. Therefore, put a little error in, and then God will go, just a mortal, and won't jump on it. And that's the exoteric reason. The internal reason is this, and it's entirely manageable. You make a mistake to put the other fellow off guard.
Get out.
To put the other fellow off guard. See? Well, individuated will is also arbitrary. There is a will to individuate is arbitrary. And the individuated level is quite all right, providing you don't identify with it to the level of forgetting that you are entirely arbitrary. When you commit yourself to an individuated declaration of purpose, if you put a lot of energy into it, you can actually forget that that purpose is designed by you, and get a funny idea that this purpose is not designed by you, but is what is called true, good, beautiful, correct, spiritually the highest. It is ethical, it is moral, it is all sorts of funny things, except this, arbitrary. Like you said, to get out. But that's rather amusing. It depends how you're thinking about it. If you think about it carefully, get out of what?
Get out of
the identification.
Yeah.
Yes, that's all right. But if you're out of the identification, you're back in this pattern again. Aren't you? Are you going to keep still?
In and out. Simultaneously.
No, but if you do it the other way, you've already solved that problem. You made the deliberate mistake to avoid annoying other people who would otherwise kill you for being perfect. You see, that's very, very important. People who are trying to impose their arbitrary patterns of being, whether it's individual, family, tribal, social, national, etc., if they are trying to establish, and the arbitrariness of other beings stops from doing it, they become very annoyed, and they have packets of energy in them which they cannot control. These are colossal volumes of energy around them in the field, and they are in suspense, waiting to come in and smash anybody who does a perfect act. Because this is a tremendous condemnation. If a person comes in and acts perfectly, without error, it produces tremendous rage. This is the meaning of the sign of the goat of Capricorn, and the birth of the Christ, and the birth of Buddha, and so on, the birth of Zarathustra. As soon as anybody looks like approximating to perfection, out come the hatchets. Because any one of those points might have thought of that good idea, just didn't. And that is very, very important. You might have thought of that brilliant idea. Who thought of the idea of deliberately annoying lots and lots and lots of rabbis and folk and getting them to nail you on a wooden cross so that you left a permanent engram in the human race, so that after 2,000 years of argument they still can't get rid of the idea of it? Who thought of that? Gautama didn't. He thought of walking about till he had a bellyache at 80 and died, talking about conquering desire for existence. That's not quite as good an idea, is it? Do you think so? Do you think it's a good idea to go about telling people the world is an illusion, It's a good thing to get out of it. The way you get out of it is simple. Give up wanting to be in it. That's simple. Now spend your life, and at 80 die of a bellyache. Why? If you're going to have a bellyache at 80, why not get crucified at 33? With a bigger bang and a more permanent mark. Because obviously Gautama was trying to make a mark. And he made a less mark in 80 years than another fellow made in 33. Now, Lao Tse chose a course, become the chief librarian to the emperor, and read all the books of wisdom, and precede them, and produce a handbook, Tao Te King. Nice little book, very nice. But has it had the same impact on the world? Is it as permanent and deeply biologically incarnate as the crucifixion idea? No, it isn't. Now, if you can think of a better idea than self-crucifixion, if you really can, don't tell anybody what it is. Do it. But make an error somewhere. Now, he made an error, a deliberate error, on the cross, didn't he? My God, why hast thou forsaken me? See? That's nice, I let some out. That has caused a lot of paper to be covered with a lot of ink marks by scholars. What did he mean with this mistake? Was it deliberate? Robert Graves says, oh, deliberate. Some other fellows say, yeah, he was quoting from the Old Testament. Some say, no, he wasn't. He was just plain scared at that moment and didn't know. But all this is arbitrary. And I would say of that little thing, that the reason he said that was because he hated not to be able to do mistakes that other people do automatically. He felt estranged, alienated from mistake makers. And at the last minute he thought, gosh, I've not made a mistake. What on earth or in heaven can I do? And he intuited this brilliant thing. And he made his mistake, and he died happily then. Having done that, he commended his spirit to God and left. Please yourself what you do with the explanation. Could have been a Muslim, you know. Nobody's quite sure of his ancestry. So here we are with this fact. Each one of these little zones of encapsulation represents one of us. And funny thing, there's an infinity of them, so no one of them can be the one, only center, chief boss and order giver. So if this fellow here says, I am the middle, we say, maybe, of this pattern, providing nobody touches it. Yeah. And this is the whole point in politics, in statesmanship, in philosophy. The object is to dispossess the other fellow of centrality. Now, if you know this, you can opt out. Either nihilistically, say, commit suicide, no good, can't make a permanent mark. Or you can opt out positively. You can say to everybody else, say, this fellow, have you ever been on centre? No. Would you like to be? Yes. Okay, you go on the centre. Aid him to go on the centre. Anybody who's not on the centre, put them on the centre. Yeah? That will at least annoy the others. And keep it moving. Won't it? Now, in the world there are two groups of men who are governing the world by agreement. One has agreed to put everybody on the centre, and the other has agreed to take everybody off centre. These are two groups. The group that put people on centre are called the right-hand path. They're good. And the ones that take them off centre are called left-hand path, and they're bad. There's a great mystery in that one. If you see somebody on centre, if they really believe that they are the one only true centre of reality, it is your plain duty, as an arbitrary definition maker of duties, to move them. And if you don't, you're allowing them to continue in this error. But if you don't, somebody else will. So do you need to bother? The positive way of opting out is saying, well, if I don't knock him off centre, some other crass idiot will. It's only a matter of time. So I don't need to do that. What I will do is watch the goldfish in the pond, the dicky bird is in the air. That's Lao Tse. You see? Or I will go about teaching them an impossible thing, like give up the worm that dies not. And he will land in a place called Nirvana, which is totally undefinable. And when you get there, you'll be so glad. But don't define it. That's another way. And then the really awkward way, say, crucify yourself. Be really smart. If you want to make a permanent mark on total reality, fixate yourself so that you don't move. You're well and truly nailed up. If you manage to keep still in this tremulous, oscillating universe, you know what will happen? They will all become aware that somebody is not oscillating. Somebody's in the middle. Every time you stand still, you are a center for the non-standstillers. Now, this is an elementary psychological and spiritual fact. If you keep still, and relative to the movers, you are a still center. Now, every spirit seeks a body. In a world of entirely arbitrary activities, at the level of pure spirit, the arbitrariness of all of them is immediate. That's very important. Immediate arbitrariness, so that as soon as you try to make a spider pattern, somebody takes the pattern away. And they're so damn quick at it. So then arose a problem. One of them thought, well, all this arbitrariness and freedom is very, very nice, but nobody can get anything done permanently. How can we see what one man would make if he were not interfered with by all these other clever fellows? How about a system of closure, self-encapsulation, so dense that nobody can interfere with it immediately? They will have to interfere with it immediately through other techniques. Now, this is the precipitation of your physical body. Your physical body is precipitated from this by condensing like this, holding up lots and lots of possibilities. Yes? It's possible that might open itself out slowly. That process of opening out you call evolution, growth. Yes? But each zone of the infinite eternal has done that. They're all in, and remember, a continuum is the same throughout itself. So there are as many zones of encapsulation in any soul as there are in any other soul. So that when I put that down and say that represents each person here, self-encapsulated and held in. He has seized, he has grabbed. In the German, in the beginning of the Bible, it says, am anfangen, fangen, to catch, to grab. The beginning is grab. Yes? In the English, say, in the beginning. That means in the house of a woman. Well, if that isn't a free translation of grab, I don't know what is. Yeah? See, I could have won that bet, couldn't I? I could have won that bet. Oh. You know, I can provoke you to double that bet as your surety increases.
Double it, but it won't be there.
You have to have your cash with you when you come for the bet. And it has to be put where I can see it. And you're going to be at the other side of the room. This is any monad with the totality of possibilities identical with any other monad and entirely arbitrary what he does. He precipitates himself like that. That is under the sign of Saturn, urn of being. And this Saturn is full of seeds, of potentialities, of possibilities, of ideas, of emotions, of wills. And you put it on the plane of existence in the time space, and then you let go of it, you let it exfoliate in the isolation of time. And it does that. And this compressed energy and these possibilities exfoliate themselves, and nothing appears except that which was locked in it. Now, this one is going a little slower than the other one. Why was that? Almost like an embryo. It's almost like a Japanese samurai on his knees about to commit harakiri. Yeah? Or anything else you care to mention? Yeah? It's a three-dimensional Rorschach test projected in two dimensions. The reason it's a bit slower now is because I held it very tight in my hot hand. Hot because it was thinking about the money I'm going to get later. See? And I've altered the molecular relation a bit. Yes. Arbitrary turning over of the beast. It may be static. Maybe it's got no capacity to exfoliate now. It might lie dormant for 1,000 universes. And then a change of temperature, it might spring out. There is no telling in an arbitrary universe whether anybody's going to be saved or not saved. This is why any mass religious conversion without individual self-perception is nonsense. If anybody could have converted the world, then the Messiah could have converted the world. And he didn't. Even in a local village, which he knew quite well. He did no marvellous works and marvelled at their unbelief. Did he say he couldn't do any marvellous works? Or he did not? This is a matter of scholarship. He marvelled at their unbelief. And their belief was necessary to the marvellous works. They were entirely arbitrary. So here we have a situation. The reason you're in a physical body is because your original preferred response pattern was continuously interfered with, spontaneously and immediately, by other monads at the spiritual level that had their preferred response patterns that they included you in. Your preferred response may involve you having a crown or a mortarboard. According to choice. Whatever it is you prefer, you are, by the act of self-definition, disqualifying another person who's already seen you and decided what to do with you. Remember Socrates? If we had no hewers of wood and drawers of water, we would not have time to think philosophically. That means those who want to think philosophically define some other being as the shoes of wood and drawers of water, and by superior definitional power persuaded those other beings into doing so. But the beings that took that without fighting back had actually thought to themselves, if we do that, we don't need to rack our brains. And in between drawing the wood and chopping the water, we'll chase the maidens. They had some arbitrary reason for allowing themselves to be subjected. Read Henry V's little discourse to the soldiers complaining to know what he thought about their complaints. They are there because they have put themselves there by what they have done. Therefore, every spirit seeks a body means this. You have an eternal, infinite, omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent self. But this self has preferred a certain response pattern, and this pattern would have been profoundly interfered with by every other spiritual monad, and you therefore decided to lock yourself up, to get into a body so that you could actually get on with your little finite preference, sheltered from the others. And then the dialectic. And when you get into the time process where you have precipitated yourself, strangely, the same idea has occurred to a lot of others. So they're now all sheltered. And they have their inner preferred responses on the inside of their consciousness, hidden in their skulls. And they're all telling lies like mad to divert each other from interfering with their preferred response patterns. But in abandoning spontaneous declaration of aim, they have done something else. In precipitating their gross material body, they haven't escaped interference as such, but only interference of a certain order, that is, immediate, spontaneous, spiritual interference, and they have replaced it with gross material, ordinary, everyday thump and black eye interference. The same thing is going on in the depths of every person. There is a preferred response pattern. It is carefully concealed. When it says Adam, after the fall, with his dear spouse, aware of their guilt, they sewed themselves skins. That meant they veiled their purposes. This skin, this integument, is a method of hiding my spontaneous spiritual intent to create a certain kind of universe. And in so doing, making myself opaque to you, I have made myself within thumping range of you at the gross material level. Therefore, all the human beings go about looking for signs in the gross body of intent and manipulating material events, digging ditches for people to fall in, making walls to keep people out. All this is done by interpretation of signs in the physical body. So the situation has not changed. It's merely altered the tempo and the density. In the physical body, people are denser than they are in the spiritual body. And they are slower. And a lot of them have forgotten how to interpret the physical signs of the preferred response. So they get confused. But those who are aware of what has really happened say, what is the technique, the method of remembering our preferred response, of regaining our immediacy, so that by our immediacy, in the realm of no immediacy, that is time, we can deserve the title conferred upon us by the Lord of Trickery, Lord Jesus Christ, be ye quick in the land of the dead. Yes? Simple. Hoi nekroi, the dead. That means those dead from the neck up. That means those in routine mental processes who are not even in their physical bodies properly. They live in fantasy. If you're in your physical body, you're called Kato. That is a fixed being. You've got a reference. You know where you are. You're driving the car. If your hand goes on a knee, it's yours. Not somebody in the passenger seat. You know your own body. Therefore, you're a fixed being. But the necroi, the deads, they don't even know that. They live in fantasies, not in their body. So the first thing to do is really get into your body, become aware of what your body is, and then use that body as a center of reference. Make a permanent center of reference. This is the meaning of the incarnation. And then, with this permanent reference center, regain, this is called the birth from above, the second birth, regain your original immediacy whilst you've still got your physical body. And then you'll be in the land of the deads and the slow And you will be able to realize your preferred response in the midst of all those other beings who are still identified with temporal linear processes of trying to get their own way.